Good morning, New Covenant. My name is Kevin Hamilton, and it's good to be with Scriptures again with you today as we worship separately and together in some cases, as I understand some folks are gathering to worship and sing and meditate on the Scriptures together. When I looked at the lectionary for today, I saw in the passage from 1 Kings chapter 19 a good place to go for us right now, given the journeys that I think we're on collectively as a church. And what I'd like to meditate on with you today in light of this passage is how this story of the great Elijah being discouraged can help us understand the relationship of our individual struggles to the collective ones, and to take encouragement about how they do connect. I've been glad that we've been for the last few weeks, several weeks, really identifying the collective struggles that we are part of as a church and naming them ever more explicitly. These struggles are all too real for us collectively. The struggles of our nation through this time of a public health crisis, an economic crisis, a leadership crisis, a coherence crisis. But we're also especially naming and being very specific about the fact that we have long been in a struggle as a nation and as a church, in a crisis of really confronting how white supremacy has invaded so much of our ways of being. So we've been naming these things with great teachers and great worship leaders. We've been describing these struggles together. And we've been describing how God's commitment all the way back to God's people through Abraham and Sarah, the patriarch and matriarch, how those promises and commitments give us hope for a larger narrative in which these collective struggles are situated. We've been naming the vision of flourishing that God has for us and leaning into that even when we see collectively our nation and our society struggling to meet that. But I imagine that you are, like me, sometimes in a place where you can name the collective story, the collective narrative. You can even, with some faith, even on the hardest days, in terms of what we see in the news and in our community, imagine that God has a plan and a story that we're moving towards, a victory for the oppressed and a victory of love. But maybe if you're like me, you have trouble connecting the individual story to that, and you wake up and go, you know, I can see the big story, but I'm not sure about my role in it. And I don't know how to relate what feels really petty, waking up in the morning with my discouragement, my personal struggles, my personal sadness. That can feel petty connected to the larger ones at times. And that can be overwhelming. And that can be self-replicating. We can get in these spirals, right, of saying, oh, I want to be part of the struggle, but I can't even get off my own problems, my own personal frustrations and struggles that have been with me for so long. And I think Elijah's story today in 1 Kings should be an encouragement to us, because looked at in the larger context of Elijah's work, I think this story is an insistence on how the larger struggles are of a piece with and the same as the individual struggles, and that where we can start to feel discouraged about how petty our individual struggles can be, that when we lose the narrative in our own individual lives, we can claim the narrative that's the same one that we claim for our collective lives, and that the victory we look to for all the dead and all the oppressed, for the victory fully realized of Jesus on the cross and the resurrection, is as true for the collective as it is for the personal and the individual. And what we see in Elijah is an affirmation of that, and a story of how God is faithful at that individual level too. What I want to focus on here as the connection between the collective and the individual that comes out for me in this story is that both are stories of freedom from fear. So to draw out the connection between the collective struggle against fear an individual struggle against fear that I see in 1 Kings' story of Elijah, I want to go back to the beginning a bit and set up the context and tell the story again of God's promise to Israel, to Abraham and Sarah and their offspring. But I want to look at it in terms of a promise of flourishing without fear. Now, in some ways, this might be an obvious thing to point out, because isn't Israel's formative story of escape from Egypt itself a rescue from life in fear? And yes, what keeps slavery in place, what keeps oppression in place, is not only the violence done to enslaved peoples, but to the fear that they live in. But I also see that Israel's emergence as a nation in that formative story into a way of living set through the law given through Moses is also a story of freedom from fear. Because the framework that the Mosaic Law provides for God's people, the way of living, is there to protect them from sliding back into fear's grip in a different way. Because fear is at the root not only of slavery's power, but at what fear is also at the root of what drives people to enslave others in the first place. Fear of want, fear of lack, quickly drives one to competition, to the amassing of power. If you are afraid of not having enough, you're going to try to hoard more, gather more, and that's going to lead you to a life dependent on power rather than on trust of God as the provider. Wherever scarcity drives you, you will inevitably end up regarding others as less than human in order to justify denying them what they need and even exploiting them in order to fill your own needs. So the law of Moses was there to protect Israel from sliding into the grip of fear, of living by fear in a different way. They escaped from fear as the oppressed. The law was there to keep them from sliding back into bondage to fear through becoming oppressors. And this is true in multiple ways all across the law. Just a couple I would name. When God feeds them manna in the desert, remember, they're only to take what they need. They're not to worry about not having enough. When eventually they do have land to farm, the law instructs them to leave enough unharvested at the margins of their fields to allow others who are in need to glean what they need. Taking only what you need and depending on God the provider rather than on your own power, your own hoarding, your own ability to win in a competition for your security. That's at the heart of Mosaic Law. And so we can read the whole longer story of Israel as one of a people who sometimes managed to stay in that life of freedom from fear, living within the frameworks God's provided, and sometimes not. When they do fall from that trust in God as provider, what they typically fall into are the fear-based ways of living practiced by their neighbors. They fall back into competition. They fall back into feeling like they've got to amass things. They've got to protect themselves from want. And that's where Elijah's story brings us. Elijah the prophet arrived on the scene as Israel's King Ahab has really taken the whole nation into living by a fear of scarcity and want, and in this case through following the religious order of Baal. The worship of Baal in Mesopotamia at that time was, just like the worship of Israel's God, a social order. It was a way of ordering all of human life, everyday living, around certain values and ideals. And whereas Mosaic Law ordered life around there always being enough because the Lord provides, the order of Baal organized around an assumption that there would never be enough. Because those who followed Baal followed a god of weather. They gathered around a common fear at that time, an understandable one, that there would not be enough rain to produce crops. And the way the followers of Baal did this was that they displaced their own fear, their own fear of not having enough, their own appetite to their deity. Because just as the followers of Baal began to live as if there would never be enough, they imagined a god who also could never have enough. Baal was never satisfied. the only way to ensure rain and plenty was to appease this endlessly dissatisfied deity with ever more valuable offerings, up to and including the offerings of their living infants and more. Mesopotamia's gods of rain were never satisfied, and neither were their priests and servants. And around the cult of Baal grew a clear social order based on power and prestige, because that's what happens when you organize yourself around lack, around scarcity. Then you begin to understand that there are different abilities to gather that power, to gather that security, and it constructs a hierarchy. To appease the appetite of the gods for followers of Baal would mean appeasing the endless appetites of Baal servants. And if you've seen a mafia film, you can kind of get the idea. There's never enough that you can give the ultimate god. There's never enough you can give the priests who have special access to that god. And on down the way, it constructs a whole order. Israel's leaders under Ahab and Jezebel had led the nation deeply into that poisonous culture of power and abuse based on fear of lack. And into that steps Elijah, zealous, angry, concerned, worried that his brothers and sisters have lost their freedom. They've become enslaved to fear. The first mention of Elijah finds him marching right up to Israel's Baal-following, fear-mongering, power-obsessed leaders to tell them that because of their actions, there will be no water for many years. This is a really great move, a real strategic and critical blow to this cult, to the order of fear to which Ahab and Jezebel and the other leaders of Israel had fallen. Because if the cult was all organized around trying to ensure water, then by removing water through calling forth a drought with God's power, Elijah kind of pulls back the curtain. Because, of course, when any kind of social order like this that's about amassing power is in a situation where they can't actually produce what they promised, what's revealed as the curtain gets pulled back is that it was never about what they promised, right? With a cult like this, it was never about the water. It was about keeping the powerful people in place, because that's what fear does. Fear drives people to organize around self-preservation, not collective preservation. And so Elijah's calling of drought into this picture is the first critical blow against the order of structural oppression, of greed, and of power to which Israel had fallen. The second blow was to take this newly revealed cult, which was really all about preservation of a few to begin with, and challenge it to show how little power it had, no matter what it brought to such a challenge. Elijah challenged, as you may remember, the priests of this fear cult to see who can call down fire from heaven, them and all their power and prestige, or him, depending on God who can deliver. And so Baal's cult sends out hundreds of priests to meet this challenge. And we read earlier in 1 Kings of how this wealthy amassing of power brought all its resources to Elijah's challenge in front of all the people. And when hundreds of these priests cannot call down fire, but Elijah all on his own can, the people really finally see who's been fooling them all along. Elijah, in other words, saved his beloved brothers and sisters from their dedication to an order of fear through a master stroke of criticism and art that opened up their senses and helped them see. Israel remembers its way because of Elijah's love for them. And then in a fit of rage against those that were in power, who had deceived them, and who had drawn them in to this order of fear, Israel then went under Elijah's leadership and slaughtered these priests of Baal. It's a brutal story. I can imagine the revenge there of these people of Israel saying, "You promised us all these things, and now we see it was all for you all along. You brought us back into slavery to fear." There's anger there. It's dark. But we also can see there that Elijah got to see what few of us dream of seeing. He got to see results in his own lifetime and in short order of a rescue and a redemption of people from their delusions, from their fear, from an order of regarding others as less than human and letting evil creep in. But this doesn't find Elijah as encouraged as you might expect. He got so much of what we hoped for. The fraudulent power is finally revealed to be only in it for itself and not for the collective, not for the people. But he hears that Israel's rulers are now jealous of his power, of his ability to reveal their fraudulent reign, and plan to kill him. And in response to this, the fear finally enters Elijah, and he runs. We've crossed now from the collective experience, from the people of Israel losing the narrative, to the individual one, where now Elijah has lost the narrative. And now we need to see how God pursues Elijah the way Elijah pursued God's people. Something has cracked for Elijah. It's pushed him past its limit. It feels like the point in the horror movie where the monster still comes back after we thought it was dead. And you can imagine Elijah going, "What was this all for anyway? Why did it even bother? This isn't supposed to be how it goes. I finally revealed these people to be total frauds and pulling the wool over the eyes of all of my brothers and sisters. This should be over, and now they're still there somehow. They're coming after me." The battle against fear got personal. So let's take a look at what this story offers us once we understand the connection of our individual struggles to the collective ones and that they're all part of the same. The struggle to remember God's narrative of salvation from fear, and God's call, God's loving call to us to live dependent on God. Once we understand that connection and see that our individual struggles are part of the cosmic struggles, what do we know about how God comes after us the way Elijah went after his brothers and sisters? When we look at the lectionary passage, what we see is first that God does pursue Elijah. That when Elijah runs into the wilderness to escape this threat of death from the powers that be, God sends an angel to follow him. God uses this angel to feed him. So this is, first of all, already demonstrating that the narrative is at work even when Elijah doesn't know it. The first contact God has with his beloved Elijah, who has now gotten taken over by fear, is not to come and shame him and to tell him what's wrong with him and ask him what in the world happened to you that you lost the narrative that you yourself were fighting for, but to say, "Oh, you're hungry. I will feed you." God showed love first. And so even though Elijah can't even see it yet, that the narrative is still at work, the narrative he's forgotten is still at work, it is working in him. The food that God provided is in Elijah when Elijah doesn't know it. It's not enough for Elijah, of course. His very senses have been dulled now. As fear entered in, he can't even see it now. So he's on the run. And you can imagine what is happening here. As fear enters in, and maybe shame enters in, that he knows he's lost the narrative, he begins to not be able to see what's around him, to not see God. He's using all of his senses just to see who might be coming after him. He's in the desert wondering what every sound might be. And we know what that's like, right? Once you begin to be afraid, you begin to devote all of your senses to trying to detect the threat. Your very internal state becomes as hungry and with as endless an appetite as Baal. It always needs more confirmation that you are secure, that you are safe, that you have enough, that you don't have to worry. And so the wilderness is not enough. Being fed is not enough. Elijah's got to run even further. So he finds a cave where he can close down even more, where he can be even more sure that there's nothing coming at him. There's only one way in. He can watch that entrance. He can listen. He can be sure of what is around him and that he is taking care of himself. But God follows him there too. And when God finally approaches him, God knows that Elijah can't hear. And instead of, again, coming first to Elijah and saying, "What's wrong with you? Don't you know about all the things I've done?" he just asks him a question. He really asks him a caring question about how he's out here, why he's out here. And so this is the next step we see in God's coming after his beloved Elijah, is that God sees Elijah in his fear, in his weakened state, in his state of not being able to see. He feeds him to preserve him, and then he extends care through checking in on him, seeing how he's doing. And of course, in response to that, Elijah doesn't even yet see this as a loving question. He has to then just defend himself. His answer to God in the lectionary there is to say, "Oh, you don't get it, God. This all this stuff happened. Now I've got to take care of myself. I'm even ashamed of myself that I'm here." God comes at him, and Elijah can't even really receive love. But the love is still there. The love is acting. And so it's significant in this story that God has to ask Elijah the question two times. God knows God's not going to get an answer. But then what God does then is should also be an encouragement to us. God prepares Elijah's very senses to finally hear the narrative again. A lot of times I've read this story and seen this dramatic display of earth and wind and fire as some sort of marker of God's power, some sort of display of awesome control and potential that's meant to kind of impress Elijah or remind Elijah of God's power. But I think there's something else there. The fact that all that is followed by silence and that God is in the silence tells me that there's a kind of preparation going on here. I was thinking about this as I was doing some walking around in some beautiful woods this week, as it was my great blessing to do. And I was following the sounds of water as I walked, the little and larger streams I crossed, the water running down from the peaks above into the streams below and working its way down to the oceans. And the sounds of water can be an orienting force there. I could hear myself getting farther away from certain water or closer to others. I could hear different sizes of streams and sounds of water that told me different things about where it was going. There was a lot of information in that because it was coming from different directions. But eventually, I came to a great rushing stream I had to cross, and once I got halfway across it and was standing in the middle of it, dry in this case, I realized that my ears were totally overwhelmed by the sound of water. That it was all around me because I was in it. And that there was really nothing I could do to turn my head and turn my body and hear that water any differently. It was a kind of overloading of data, an oversaturation of my senses. And I began to think about this passage since I was meditating on it this week, and think about how the sounds of the earthquake, the sounds of the fire, the sounds of the wind to Elijah hiding in that cave must have been that kind of reset, that kind of reorientation through overload. Remember, he was listening so vigilantly. He was making every sound into something that was not even there, right? Every snap of a twig, every drop of water in that cave must have made him think, "Oh, is that someone coming to get me?" And so God, knowing that Elijah couldn't even hear God, when God finally came to Elijah with the narrative again, to remind him of the narrative, prepared Elijah's senses through overloading them. I think that's an interesting, at least another example in the story of God's great love for Elijah, the same way Elijah has its great love for his brothers and sisters. But maybe that's also a provocation to us to ask, where might God be doing that for us? Where might, in our place of individual inability to hear the narrative, is God overloading you in some way? Is God resetting your senses in some way? And I don't mean the news. We're all struggling with that. We read the news and that gets overloading and we get deadened and we shut it off. But are there other ways in which our desire to orient ourselves is getting lovingly thwarted so that we can realize that we can't get enough information. We can't get enough data to really keep us safe, to really keep us secure, to really keep us sure in our own abilities. We have to depend on God. And after that overloading, which I can even imagine is a beautiful experience as someone who loves really overwhelming music and overwhelming sounds of streams, Elijah is finally ready. And where does God go with that? He just goes back to the narrative. God reminds Elijah of his place in the narrative by saying what happens next. All right, on your way back from the wilderness, you're going to find someone else to anoint as king. You're going to also find someone else to work with, Elisha. And there's going to be a remnant of people who are able to continue believing that God is enough and that Israel is not going to snap back to its former state before Elijah had revealed the fraud that was in power. It's so striking to me that this is so different from the stories of Job, from the stories of Jonah, all these other stories in which God had to come at a lost one with all these reminders, just like reminding the lost one about all the things God has done and trying to convince the lost one of God's faithfulness. Here is just feed Elijah, pursue Elijah, ask about Elijah's well-being, prepare Elijah to hear, and then return Elijah to the narrative. And off he went. Elijah restored again. So I hope you can take this as some encouragement today, that where you're individually struggling, it is of a piece with the larger struggles and not separate from it. Your struggle is not smaller in the piece of things and therefore something to be ashamed of. Your story of struggling against fear and against sliding into that scarcity mentality is right there of a piece with the struggle that our larger society is with. And that just as God goes after the collective with this narrative of promise as fulfilled in Jesus, God goes after the individual. And I hope you can listen this week to where God is there, even when you can't hear, feeding you, pursuing you, preparing you to hear the story again. As we conclude and return to worship and for some to communion, I want to pray here for us in our individual and collective work. God, some of us really are in places of fear and shame about our own abilities to contribute to the larger picture here. And God, so many of us in response to that are like Elijah. We try to find more information. We try to find some way to check, are we doing enough? Are we in a good enough place individually? Is there more we can learn about the world that we might be missing, that we could be acting about? We get into that fear mode that Elijah was in, listening in every direction for where danger might be coming, for where his own personal failure might be coming, running from that failure and losing the narrative. God, it is a blessing to read this story of your pursuit of someone in just that position. And many of us in this congregation have experienced that before, have turned to realize that you were there pursuing us. So as we move back into worship and move back into our week, I pray that those stories of seeing God's pursuit of us individually return to us, that we share them with one another, and that, Lord, we look around to see where you were feeding us and we didn't even know it, and where what felt like overload and fear triggering was the sound of earth quaking, the sound of water rushing, the sound of fire, purging our senses and preparing us through your loving preparation to hear what we really needed to hear, which is that your story has been marching along all along and that we had just forgotten how to see it. Amen.